action on him, most likely. I've got to report this to Voznesensky, you realize, he said.
Yeah, I know.
This transmission is automatically monitored by the orbiter and Kaliningrad. Connors nodded glumly. Pursing his lips as though deep in careful thought, Reed at last offered, I will recommend to Mikhail Andreevich that you stay where you are for the next 24 hours. A dose of wide-spectrum antibiotic won't hurt you. I'll send specific written instructions over the computer link, then we'll see how you feel tomorrow morning.
Okay, great.
The astronaut was as grateful as a puppy. Reed terminated the conversation, then turned to his medical computer file and tapped out a prescription for the antibiotic. He pushed himself up from the chair slowly, reluctantly. I must face Voznesensky, he told himself. Nothing for it but to beard him in his own den. Still, he dreaded the confrontation. The Russian was in the ward room, huddled over a mug of steaming tea, talking in low, earnest tones with Mironov in their native language. They both looked sick to Reed's professional eye. Haggard, sallow complexions, even their coveralls looked baggy and rumpled, not at all the neat aspect that they had presented only a few days earlier. Whatever it is, they've got it. And all the others, too, all except me, and possibly Toshima. Reed felt absurdly normal, healthy and strong, clear-headed and alert. He had even cut down on his morning amphetamine cocktail to check whether or not his seeming good health was a chemically induced artifact. The two Russians both looked up as Tony pulled out a chair and joined them. The team in the rover is down with it, Reed told them quietly. Whatever it is. Fatigue, Voznesensky said immediately. Psychological fatigue. I have seen it on long-duration missions in orbit. After only 37 days, Reed almost sneered. We have been in space for almost a year.
Ah, yes, Reed admitted. True enough. The stresses of this environment, Mironov started, but his voice trailed off weakly. Mars is no more stressful than the moon or an orbiting space station, Reed said. Rather less stressful, actually, I should think.
Then what is it? Voznesensky growled. What is happening to us?
Reed shook his head.
Whatever it is, it's affecting everyone here with the same symptoms. Weakness, pains in the limbs, headaches.
It is the flu, Mironov said. Cocking an eyebrow at him, Reed said,
How could we all come down with the flu nearly a year after leaving Earth? Influenza viruses don't lie dormant for that long. If it were the flu, we would have seen it long before this.
Unless it's a slow virus, Tony suddenly thought, like Legionnaire's disease or some such. Mironov looked stubbornly unconvinced.
But no one in orbit has it,
Reed pointed out, arguing as much with himself as with the cosmonaut.
The Martian flu, Voznesensky half-joked. It is patently impossible to contract a disease from a planet that is without any life of its own, Reed snapped, almost angrily. There are no viruses here to infect us. Even if there were Martian microbes, they would not be adapted to our cells. Mars could be covered with all sorts of bugs, but they wouldn't bother us at all. Couldn't, actually. That is the theory of the doctors, Mironov mumbled gloomily.
Perhaps this is not a disease at all, Voznesensky said.
Not a disease?
Coal miners get black lung, Voznesensky said, not from germs, but from breathing in coal dust.
Reed stared at him. This cosmonaut actually has a brain inside that thick skull.
Perhaps there is something in the Martian dust that is affecting us, Voznesensky said.
But we take great care to keep the dust out of our suit and out of our living habitat, Reed pointed out.
The dust is very fine. Perhaps we do not take great enough care.
I hadn't thought of that, said Reed.
Mironov said,
We could check the air in here, see how much dust is suspended in it.
Yes, said Voznesensky, we must do that. Reed was about to reply when Toshima came rushing up to the table. He was wide-eyed with excitement. If the Martian flu had hit him, he showed no evidence of it.
The dust storm! Toshima fairly shouted. It has started!
Sol 37, afternoon. Grounded. Jamie felt like an errant teenager being punished by his parents.
The rover was in perfectly good shape, and even though he felt weak and headachy, he saw no reason why he should not be moving onward, closer to the village he had seen. "That's where we've got to go," he kept telling himself. "Maybe I can even climb up there once we get to the base of the cliffs where that cleft is. I'll bet there's even a natural path up the cliff face to that cleft and the formation inside it. Or maybe they carved steps out of the rock." The day outside seemed perfectly clear, despite Toshima's insistence that a dust storm was howling down the length of the canyon and would soon engulf them. There had even been the mists out there earlier in the morning, thin gray tendrils of haze that hovered in the early morning chill and slowly evaporated as the sun reached down into the canyon, like ghosts that vanish when the light touches them, Jamie thought. If the mists evaporate and then form again the next morning, he reasoned, either the moisture remains inside the canyon, or it's renewed from some source of water vapor underground, or in the cliff walls. Christ, there's so much for us to look for, and they've got us stuck inside this aluminum can. For the 40th time that morning, he paced the length of the rover's command module, from the cockpit bulkhead past the little galley and the narrow passage between the folded-up bunks to the equipment racks, and finally the airlock at the back end. Connors called from the cockpit, "I think it's starting." Jamie rushed the 9 strides it took to span the module's length and ducked his head past the bulkhead. Through the cockpit's bulbous canopy, the canyon outside seemed just the same as the last time he had looked. Connors anticipated him. "Take a squint at the sky." Jamie slid into the empty seat beside the astronaut so he could look upward. The pink sky seemed normal enough. Almost. "It's gotten 10% darker in the past 5 minutes," Connors said, holding up a color comparison chart. "It's really going to be a storm." "Yeah. I'd better go back and tell the others." "Might as well. We got nothing else to do." Connors slipped on his headset as he spoke and reached for the comm unit's switch. Ioana and Ilona were sitting so close together in the lab module that their shoulders almost touched. The lighting was low, more from the glowing displays on the computer screens than from the dimmed overhead strip lamp. Neither of the women looked up as Jamie stepped in from the airlock. They were both bent over something on the workbench. "The storm is starting," Jamie said. Ioana turned her head slightly to look at him over her shoulder. In the dimness, he could not make out the expression on her face, only that she seemed terribly pale. "The figures on the core samples are on the screen here," she said, tapping the computer humming beside her. "Anything interesting?" "See for yourself," she said, turning back to the work she and Ilona were doing. Jamie frowned slightly at her abrupt manner. He leaned over, since there were no other chairs in the lab, and read off the figures on the screen. Not much different from the values they had gotten from other corings, he saw, except that there was no ice in the sample, no layer of permafrost. "Then where's the water coming from?" Jamie asked himself. He punched up a side-by-side display that compared the results of the core samplings taken near the dome with those from here in the canyon. Trivial differences, much less than Jamie had expected, except for the water. "There's less water here than up on the plain." "Less? That doesn't make any sense." The wind was keening outside. Straightening up, Jamie felt a kink in his back. He had been bent over longer than he had realized. The wind was really singing now. There were no windows in the lab module, no way to see what was going on outside. Ioana and Ilona were still bent over their work. The diamond saw buzzed briefly, then whined as it bit through rock. "I'm going up front to see what the storm looks like," he said. "Good," said Ioana, without raising her head. Curious, he asked, "What the hell are you working on that's so fascinating?" "Go up front, Jamie, and leave us alone. We will call you when we are ready to talk." "Son of a bitch," Jamie grumbled to himself. Then he remembered how proprietary Ioana had become when they had found the green-streaked rock. Half puzzled, half angry, he made his way back into the command module. Connors was still up in the cockpit, munching on a candy bar, headset still clamped against his ear, although he had swung the microphone arm up and away from his mouth. "Toshima says we'll be in this for the rest of the day," he announced glumly. Jamie stared at the scene outside. The wind was howling like a squalling infant, high-pitched and thin. It had become quite dark out there, an eerie kind of fluctuating darkness, not like nighttime, even though the lighting level was down to about its value just after sunset. Shadow.